This is Audible.
Love Your Life, Not Theirs. 7 Money Habits for Living the Life You Want by Rachel Cruze. Read by Rachel Cruze.
Dedication to my daughter, Amelia. You were with me every step of the way on this book. Finding out I was pregnant with you right as we started working on this project helped me see this book in a new light. Since I started the first drafts while I was pregnant and worked on it throughout your first year, I feel like we wrote this book together. You have brought me more joy in my life than I could have ever imagined, and you are, by far, my greatest accomplishment. I love you more than you'll ever know. Acknowledgements. Turning an idea into a book is one of the hardest, most exciting things I ever get to do. There is no way I'd be able to do it without the help of the amazing team I get to work with every day. I'd like to say a special word of thanks to Winston Cruze for being the most supportive husband in the world. I am so thankful for you cheering me on throughout this process and for believing in me. I fall more in love with you every day. Dave and Sharon Ramsey, my parents for giving me the strong foundation that led to the principles in this book. Your strength and courage in facing your past money mistakes have changed our family's future for generations to come. Alan Harris and Preston Cannon, for your great leadership throughout the editorial and publishing process. Ben Stroop, my editor for this project, for helping me nail down and organize the millions of ideas I had for this book. Jen Gingrich, for your outstanding editorial and development help. Luke Lefevre and Tim Newton, for overseeing all the design elements and cover art. Meg Grunke, my friend and publicist, for helping me get the word out about this book and for sticking with me over the thousands of miles and hundreds of media appearances. Suzanne Sims, Jen Severson, Jeremy Breland, Brian Williams, Blake Thompson, Andy Barton, Corey Mabry, Robert Bruce, Aaron McAtee, Laura Johnson, and so many others for their time, prayers, and hard work as we brought this book to life. Introduction. I hate the sound of my alarm clock. There I am, perfectly happy, content, and warm in my bed, just dreaming away, when, out of nowhere, that annoying upbeat ring starts going off. My alarm jolts me out of dreamland and drops me into a new, and much too early, morning. It takes everything in me not to hit the snooze button or throw my phone across the room. I'm not even sure God's awake at 5 a.m., but I am. Oh, how things have changed. It wasn't always like this. Early in my career, I'd wake up around 7 a.m., roll out of bed, get ready in a rush, grab some coffee, and run out the door to get to work on time. Most mornings felt like a blur, and my body was basically on autopilot while my brain kept on snoozing. I didn't value or even enjoy that first hour of the day. My morning habit was simple. Get up, get ready, and get out as quickly as possible. But my life's a lot different now. When I became a mom, I realized pretty quickly that if I wanted to have any time to myself at all during the day, I would have to get up early. The demands of being a wife, mother, speaker, writer, and frequent traveler can exhaust me if I don't secure a few precious moments of peace and quiet each morning. I need time to prepare for the day ahead of me by gathering my thoughts and enjoying a cup of coffee before my daughter wakes up and I have to get her and myself ready. If I skip that first part of my day, I don't feel as focused or productive. And if I try to carve out some quiet time for myself later in the day, it would never happen. The only way for me to have this time was to create a new morning habit of getting up a couple of hours earlier than before. That meant I would have to get up before the sun and get used to seeing 5 a.m. flashing on my phone's alarm. Getting up that early used to feel like a punishment. Now, it feels like a gift. I'll admit, the first few weeks of this new routine were a little rough. I was tired, I got mad at myself for staying up too late the night before, and I wasn't used to tiptoeing around the house in the dark. Over time, though, I grew to value those early morning hours. I liked how having that time made me feel. I felt more present with my husband, Winston, and our daughter. Now I don't even have to think about it. I just do it. It has become a habit for me. Living with habits. people tend to have different reactions to the word habit. Some people think of habits in a negative light. Their minds immediately jump to bad habits like cracking knuckles, biting fingernails, or smacking gum. The thought of creating new habits may seem overwhelming, and the thought of breaking old bad habits may sound intimidating. These people cringe when I bring up the idea of habits because they're naturally inclined to think that I'm calling them out on something that they need to change, and that sounds like a lot of work to them. Other people see habits in more of a positive light. They think of habits as healthy disciplines that enhance their lives. They view turning off their smartphones during dinner to focus on quality time with their family, saving up to pay cash for purchases, working out regularly, eating healthy food, most of the time at least, setting the house alarm before walking out the door, and brushing their teeth at least twice a day, all as good habits. These people light up when I talk about habits because they're always looking for some life hack to get where they want to go. We all have habits. The word habit means acting or behaving in a usual or predictable way. It's what a person does on a regular basis. Habits are those things you do that you don't have to think that hard about. An automated response to what's happening around you. My old morning routine, get up, get ready, get out, was definitely a habit. That's what I meant when I said I was on autopilot. The habit took over, so my body just knew what to do while my brain continued to snooze. Charles Duhigg talks about this in his incredible book, The Power of Habit. He writes, "When a habit emerges, the brain stops fully participating in decision-making. It stops working so hard, so unless you deliberately fight a habit, the pattern will unfold automatically. When a choice is made consistently, it becomes a habit. And habits, according to Duhigg, are automatic. In other words, you don't even have to think about them. For example, how hard do you think about each turn in your daily commute? How often do you get lost on your way to work or to your kid's school? I've driven the same route so much that my brain shuts down a little when it's time to drive to work. In fact, I had an experience like this not too long ago. I needed to pick a few things up at our local warehouse store, which is located one street over from my office. Apparently, I was completely zoned out while I was driving because the next thing I knew, I was sitting in my office parking lot, in my normal parking spot, on a Saturday. I laughed at myself when I came to my senses because I knew exactly what had happened. I was heading in the direction of my office, so my drive to work habit took over. Even though I was working on a book about money habits at the time, I was still surprised at how powerful that routine was. It made me realize how important it is not just to be aware of your habits, but also to take control of them if you want to truly take control of your life. Facing our money habits. Habits affect every area of our lives, including our health, careers, relationships, and especially our money. We all have money habits. Some are good and some are bad. Some take us closer to where we want to be, while others take us further and further away. You may be in the habit of using cash for purchases, or you may instinctively grab a credit card from your wallet whenever you're in a checkout line. You may have a habit of talking to your spouse before making major purchases, or you may have an impulsive habit of hiding your purchases when you get home. Like it or not, our money habits impact our financial lives every single day. And because of this, we have got to figure out how to harness the power of habit in order to live the lives we want. That doesn't mean I always enjoy it when a healthy habit kicks in. I am a natural spender. We'll talk more about that later, but for now, I'll just admit that I love spending money. Some people are natural savers, and some people are natural spenders. Spending is my natural bent. However, I have some healthy money habits that keep my spending in check. So, when I walk through the doors of J.Crew, my natural impulse is to buy everything in sight. Those instincts crash against my habit of not using debt, planning my spending, and talking to my husband about my purchases. Those habits Winston and I have carefully added to our lives, and they're setting us up to live the life we want and do the things that we value over the long term. So if occasionally feeling a little tension in J.Crew enables us to hit the goals that we've set for ourselves, then sign me up. The truth is, though, breaking bad money habits and replacing them with good ones is often easier said than done, especially if you don't realize how much your bad habits are wrecking your life. I've talked to people who went years, even decades, going deeper and deeper into debt. When they wanted something, they just charged it with their credit card. It was an automatic response for them. They had no concept of the damage it was doing in their lives. Even if they suspected that there was a problem with their spending habits, they hadn't felt the pain to change. And without that little push, it can be incredibly difficult to come up with the emotional energy to change a long-standing habit. But if you want to change your life, if you want to do the things that you've always wanted to do, buy the things you've always wanted to buy, and go to places you've always wanted to go, then you're going to have to find the motivation to change your money habits. You need to aim the power of habit at the behaviors that will make your life better instead of tearing it apart one mistake at a time. And don't worry about the mistakes you've made in the past. I'm not interested in beating you up for past mistakes. I want to encourage you to make wise choices and to build healthy habits moving forward. I can't promise it'll be easy, but I can promise it will lead to a happier, healthier, more peaceful life. A life without all the debt, stress, and worry that so many of our friends and family members are dealing with right now. Let's get to work. You have the opportunity to create the life you want. Though it may not feel like it right now, it's within reach. Not 30 years from now, but right now. Change happens when you own up to the choices you make. If you don't like the outcomes you've created for yourself, such as debt, unhappiness, or dissatisfaction, then start making different choices that will create new habits in your life. As we go through this book, I will shine a spotlight on the habits you need to take control of your money and to be able to afford the things you value. These money habits may not come easy to you, and you may not get it right every time. But as Larry Gelwick says, practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. And permanent, positive change is what we're after. Some of the principles in this book may sound familiar, and there's a reason for that. My dad, Dave Ramsey, has been teaching many of these things for decades. And before Dave Ramsey, there were financial giants like Larry Burkett, Howard Dayton, and Ron Blue teaching basic personal finance to everyday people. Ideas like staying out of debt, using cash for purchases, talking to your spouse about money, and living on a budget aren't new, revolutionary ideas. The problem isn't that people haven't heard of what to do. The real problem is that most people just don't do it. And in an age of one-click purchasing, social media pressure, online banking, and instant gratification, things are only getting worse. I grew up with these principles. I've never used debt. And I learned at a young age to make a plan for my money. I know this stuff works, but the world has changed a little bit since Dad first started talking to people on the radio. This generation of young families is facing new pressures and temptations that our parents never had to deal with. Today's challenges and opportunities are uniquely ours, so let's figure out how to manage them together. While I'd love only to be that friend who cheers you on, there are times when I'm going to have to be the friend who cares enough to tell you when you're getting off track with your money. That means I'll be addressing some bad money habits you may already have, because I know how easy it can be to allow bad habits to take you far off course. As we get started, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that we're going to start with the one habit that has the power to change your financial life more than any other, and it's not what you think it is. The bad news is that it might slap you in the face with something you don't want to deal with quite yet. It might be a little tough, but it's a worthwhile journey. Breaking, building, and rebuilding habits can be hard work, but it's the only way to get the life you've always dreamed of. Are you ready? Let's get to work. Habit 1, quit the comparisons. Chapter 1, comparisons are killing us. Winston and I were in our second year of marriage. We were in our first career jobs, making decent salaries, but nothing out of the ordinary for a young couple a few years out of college. One night over dinner, we started talking about the future. We laughed and dreamed about the things we wanted to accomplish in our marriage, family, and careers. During our conversation, we talked about taking a trip to a place we had never been before. We really hadn't gone anywhere together since our honeymoon, and the thought of a fancy getaway got us both excited. We were what some people call dinks, dual income, no kids, which meant that we had some discretionary income to take a short trip together. We had heard many great things about Charleston, South Carolina. Friends who had been there couldn't say enough good things about the storied coastal town. Once we priced out the flights and hotel, we realized that we only had enough cash to cover an extended weekend, but that was fine. We were just excited to get away together for a few days. We had a couple of months to save before the trip, so we squeezed every dollar we could out of our budget to put toward the getaway. We checked out all the restaurants online, made reservations, looked up fun things to do, and planned the weekend practically down to the minute. And since Winston and I both stay incredibly busy at work, we both agreed to make this a no-work, all-play trip. The day we finally left for South Carolina, I could feel months of stress roll off as the plane hit the air. It was time to relax. Charleston, just in case you were wondering, was amazing. The food was outstanding, the people were friendly, it was everything people had said it was, and more. So much culture, elegance, and history. We didn't want to leave, but we had to come back to reality. So we decided then and there that this would be a place we would come back again and again. As soon as we got home, I plopped down on the couch and mindlessly scrolled through my Instagram feed. What better way to spend my afternoon than catch up on my friend's foodie, baby, and cat pictures, right? One of the first photos I saw was posted by a fashion blogger I follow, someone I don't know personally. She was on a trip to Europe that week. Not just Europe, but Greece. And not just Greece, but all the Greek Isles. And of course, she was sailing from one to the other on this incredible yacht. Oh yes, I said a yacht. And the picture showed it all. The unbelievable yacht, perfect setting, and most delicious looking food I had ever seen. All I could think about was what it must feel like to walk in her shoes, which were probably all designer, hey there, Jimmy Choo, and live her life. Ever land on someone else's feet and wish you were living their life in that moment? That was me. So, while scrolling through her pictures, with the warm glow of my fantastic trip to Charleston fading fast, I did what any normal, healthy person would do. I looked up airline tickets to Greece. No other vacation would do. It was Greece or bust. I was already looking up the price of airline tickets before I snapped back to reality. We were newlyweds on a newlywed budget. We couldn't even afford to get to Greece, let alone pay for the resorts, excursions, and food. What's worse, Winston and I had just got back home from an amazing trip together. But instead of basking in the experience, all I could think about was how much better this person's trip was than mine. Suddenly, our fantastic trip to South Carolina seemed a little dull. And just like that, I had entered the comparison game. I was comparing a stranger's exciting vacation to a wonderful trip I had just taken with my husband, and allowing her trip to steal my joy. It took a little while to shake off the sudden need to go to Europe, but I thought about that whole experience for a long time after. Why would I let someone else's trip to Greece make me feel so anxious? What was it about her trip that made my trip feel so inadequate? I had to come to terms with the fact that I was caught up in comparisons. I was chasing someone else's life instead of enjoying my own. I was letting someone I had never met influence not only how I was going to spend my money, but how I was going to live my life. Chasing make-believe. You would think I would have learned my lesson, but a few weeks later, I was back at it again. This time, I was captivated by pictures of a friend's remodeled kitchen. It was beautiful. Her kitchen looked like a home featured in a magazine or on one of those home improvement shows. The beautiful granite, the lights, the cabinets, everything was perfectly coordinated. Without even realizing it, I started walking around my house, planning what I needed to change immediately. To make matters worse, I had actually just spent a little money updating the decor in our living room, and I was really happy with it. But then I saw what someone else had and felt the need to keep up. And it only took a split second for my thoughts to make that turn. Suddenly, I was comparing my home to hers, and I was no longer satisfied with what I had. After getting hit in the face with the comparison game twice in such a short time, I decided it was time to face the disgusting comparison monster head on. I realized comparisons will not only steal our joy, but our paychecks as well. If we don't get comparison living under control, we will constantly spend money just trying to keep up. The comparisons in our pockets. Comparison living is nothing new. I know that every generation in history of the world has struggled with it to some degree or another. Hey, the instruction not to covet is even one of the Ten Commandments. But I really believe something has changed in the past 10 years or so, and I believe it's tied to social media. 30 years ago, when my parents were my age, the term keeping up with the Joneses was pretty common. That was in the mid-80s, at what some would call the height of consumerism. If Dad came home and saw a brand new car in the neighbor's driveway, he probably felt some urge to go and get a nicer car himself. I get it. But here's what's different today. Back then, my parents actually had to be within eyeshot of the neighbor's new purchase. They had to see the Joneses' car in person before the comparison impulse kicked in. Today, however, we carry the Joneses around in our back pockets. Our cell phones and social media apps are little windows into the lives of other people. If a friend on the other side of the world bought a new purse today, a picture of it would hit my phone before she even left the store. Despite all the value networks like Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook have brought to the world, there's one glaring negative that we have to face openly and honestly. These channels make it easier than ever for us to wish that we were living someone else's life. And what I've come to realize is that when we start comparing ourselves to other people, we're playing a game we will never win. Better than reality. One of the most frustrating parts of social media is that it's not always real life. Most of what you see on Facebook and Instagram is enhanced. It's a public display of our best self. We usually put our best foot forward on social media and the pictures we post. Some people even go to the extreme, perfecting every detail. They take 50 different shots before posting the one perfect, candid beach photo. You scroll through your feed and see a picture of your coworker's brand new car with the caption, #blessed. This sudden urge to keep up overwhelms you. But comparing yourself to the proverbial Joneses is a dead end. You have to remember that the Joneses may actually be broke, and what you're seeing isn't always the real story. I find it hilarious that no one ever posts a picture of their rusted, paid-for 92 Camry on Facebook and tags it with #blessed. Why? Because that trusty old car doesn't seem as exciting as the brand new Tahoe. Taking things one step further from reality, Instagram now offers the Joneses nearly 24 different filters to make them look extra tan and any ocean they're laying beside look extra blue. It's probably safe to say that we're all guilty of this. Hey, if it's a cold January afternoon and an Instagram filter can put a nice warm glow on my face, what's the harm? Thank you, lo-fi filter, for enhancing our reality. Yes, there might be a picture in your social media feed that involves a family laughing while picnicking in the park. But what you don't see are the 37 bad shots they deleted before they finally got a good one. And I'm guilty of this too. I don't want to put a goofy-looking picture of my daughter on Facebook. Of course not. I do all I can to get her to laugh. And then when I get the cute little grin that I'm looking for, you better believe that's the picture I want to share with the world. Here's the point. When you get caught up in social media comparisons, you're comparing yourself to make-believe. And when you compare yourself to make-believe, your real life will never feel good enough. Am I good enough? Even though social media is probably the easiest place to compare, we can't forget about comparisons in real life and real time. Regardless of what stage of life you're in, it can seem impossible to avoid the comparison trap altogether. No matter what we do, where we go, or what we buy, someone is always there doing more, going further, and buying better. From jobs and houses to clothes and cars to schools and strollers, yes, people, even strollers, the list goes on and on. The rat race. What's weird is that this is true even if you're starting in the same place as someone else. When I think about people I went to college with, I can see that we all kind of got off to the same start. Everyone's job is at the bottom rung when it comes to salary and responsibilities. Because we're all in it together, it's like we emotionally lock arms with each other and do the work necessary to get ahead while making starter salaries. You're in your early 20s, and that's exactly where you're supposed to be in this stage of life. But most people don't stay there for long. As you move out of the recent college graduate stage, situations and circumstances start to change. Some people rapidly progress through their careers. Others seem to stay stagnant longer than others. Some get married. Some have kids early and leave the workforce. Some never seem to advance personally or professionally, and they act like they're still in college. And as a result of that, incomes and lifestyles begin to change. Bigger houses, exotic vacations, expensive jewelry, and fancy cars start filling up our social media feeds. We think, how can they afford that car? They make the same salary as I do. Or, they're going to Disney again? We haven't even been once. Somehow our friends' lives start to look better than ours, and that nagging sense of comparison creeps into our thinking. It changes our attitudes, and just as sadly, our relationships with the people we're comparing ourselves to. Competitive parenting. Once you bring kids into the picture, it's a whole new ballgame. When I told a good friend that we were pregnant, one of her first comments was, "Welcome to the world of comparisons." I had no idea how true this would be. The comparisons among pregnant friends began immediately. Are you sick? Did you actually throw up or you just feel nauseated? Oh yes, some women compare how bad their morning sickness is. But it didn't stop there. Other gems included, are you still working out? Translation, how much weight have you gained? Have you registered for baby gifts yet? Where? Oh no, not there. You need to register here instead. What kind of stroller did you get? Did you get your baby furniture at Pottery Barn Kids? Or did you just go with the cheap stuff? After 9 months of this, I thought I experienced the worst of it. I found out just how wrong I was the instant our daughter Amelia was born. Practically the day we brought her home, we were hit with what best could be called competitive parenting. Has your baby rolled over yet? Can she hold her head up yet? Has she walked? Is she sleeping through the night? Oh, that's the stroller you decided to go with? Did your baby smile at 4 weeks? Because mine did. Are you nursing? What preschool is your child going to? She hasn't started crawling yet? Insanity. Every question makes you feel inadequate, like you're doing something wrong, and the cycle of comparison continues. Looking at each other. Even our daily routines are filled with comparisons. It starts on Sunday. There is that family in your small group who pulls into the parking space beside you at church. When they get out, there isn't a wrinkle in sight. Designer and boutique clothes are all coordinating. Makeup and hair is perfect. Their kids are so well behaved. Suddenly you feel like you aren't doing enough. Then Monday morning comes around, and you're sitting in the carpool line waiting to drop your child off at school. You can see your reflection in the shine of the luxury car in front of you, and you notice how put together the kids are as they pop out of the car. When you get to work, your coworker tells you all about his exciting weekend of late nights with friends and fancy food. Before you've even had your first cup of coffee, you're wondering why you can't get your life together and have what other people have. And that's when you ask yourself, does this ever end? The answer, my friend, is no. No, it doesn't. But you can put an end to it yourself. Yes, you can move past the comparisons that may be killing you right now. It's possible. The cure begins within. I'm afraid it's time for a little tough love. You ready? Here it is. Comparing ourselves to others is essentially a coping mechanism for our own insecurities. We believe that we don't measure up, so we project our insecurities onto others. We are insecure about how we look, how our kids are dressed, how our houses are decorated, and so on. And it's those insecurities, our own internal struggles, that are keeping us from living the kind of life that we love. We can't blame social media, and we can't blame the Joneses. They're doing the same thing we are, just trying to figure out how to love our lives. Once you take the focus off of them and put it back onto your own life, you can start to turn things around with your life and money. Clearing our vision. As we compare our lives to other people, we fall into a dangerous trap. We make assumptions about other people's lives and situations, and those assumptions are often wrong, or at least incomplete. You know that laughing in the park family we talked about earlier? They may seem to have the most incredible life. They may be the family that seems to have it all together based on the school their kids attend, their house, and the amazing beach vacations they take with their kids at least 3 times a year. And you know this because they post all the pictures on Facebook. Sure, you know the family I'm talking about. We all know that family. Everything seems just perfect for them. What we may not stop to consider, though, is that there's a chance that their marriage is stressed. They have no margin with their money because their paycheck comes in and goes right back out in payments. They have no margin with their time because he works 24/7 just to keep up the appearances of the perfect life. But the other side of the coin is true as well. This is where I'm guilty sometimes. I can see a picture of that family on the gorgeous vacation, usually around the same time I'm craving a vacation myself, and I immediately think, sure, they look happy, but I bet they aren't. I bet they couldn't even pay for that vacation with cash. They probably charged everything on their credit card. They're probably over there yelling at each other right now. Guilty as charged. But the truth is, we have no idea what's going on behind the scenes in anyone else's family, unless they tell us, of course. They really could be the happiest, healthiest, wealthiest family in the world. Or they could be broke, miserable, and a fight away from a divorce. Or, more likely, they're somewhere in the middle. We just don't know. We can't know. Our assumptions, good or bad, are meaningless. They don't change the other family situation. And they don't change our situation. It's a waste of energy, and frankly, it's none of our business. A problem we make for ourselves. I believe the game of comparisons is a problem in our own making. These are pressures we put on ourselves. We spend so much money, time, energy, and attention trying to bridge the gap that doesn't even exist. You may have been a little uncomfortable reading this chapter. Trust me, it was uncomfortable for me to write a lot of it. But I'm done with the denial. The truth is, most of us deal with comparisons each and every day. It doesn't make us bad people. It doesn't mean we're selfish or jealous or envious of our friends. It just means we're human. We can't blame ourselves for the thoughts that pop into our heads, but we can take responsibility for what we do with those thoughts. Are we going to nurture the comparisons and wallow in our own discontentment? Or are we going to stop those thoughts in their tracks and enjoy the life that's in front of us? It's a struggle sorting through all the thoughts and feelings we have about others and the lives that they're living. But if we really want to love our lives, we've got to come face to face with bad habits that are holding us back. We are spending money we may or may not have just to keep up a life we think we're missing out on. And that is running not only our emotional lives, but our financial lives as well. As a culture, I truly believe we've made a habit of comparing our lives to others, and it's time to break that habit. We'll talk about how to do that in the next chapter. Chapter 2, Blessed versus #blessed. There's a fascinating phenomenon repeating itself on social media these days, and we've all seen it. It's there, lurking at the end of half the posts you see online. It's the smiley, happy exclamation point at the end of a friend's latest post about her fantastic vacation. Most of the time, you can see it coming before you even get to the end of the photo caption. It's the latest weapon in the comparison-driven war of the one-upmanship currently being waged on your favorite social networks. Yes, you know what's coming. I'm talking about hashtag blessed. Look at what my amazing husband gave me for our anniversary. Hashtag blessed. Honored to accept my new position as executive vice president of sales for a Fortune 500 company. Hashtag blessed. I can't believe this view out of my new bedroom window. Hashtag blessed. Jetting off to Hawaii for a long weekend. Hashtag blessed. I've always wanted a Lexus. Hashtag blessed. Oh, he shouldn't have. Hashtag blessed. And the pictures. Oh, the pictures. Amazing sunsets, feet in the sand, six-pack abs, rooftop pools, first-class airline seats. Hashtag blessed. Hashtag I love him so much. Hashtag treating myself. Hashtag YOLO. I'll be the first to admit that I'm guilty of using hashtag blessed in the past. But once I became more aware of this habit of comparison living, I started paying more attention to when, where, and why people throw that little hashtag around. And almost every time I see it now, I translate it as a humble brag. Am I saying that everyone who uses hashtag blessed means to imply that? No way. I know some of the sweetest, most caring, and generous people in the world. There's no way that that's what they meant to say. There are others, though, who know exactly what they're implying with it. We can't control that. All we can control is what our response is when we see it. If we seriously want to develop a habit of quitting the comparisons, we've got to take control of our thoughts and reactions to other people's stuff and success. We need to choose real blessings and let go of someone else's hashtag blessed. So how do we do that? How to quit the comparisons. Quitting the comparisons is an easy thing to say, but it's no easy thing to do. It can be tough to identify clear steps to win. I haven't figured it all out yet. After all, this is something I'm still working on myself. However, I can share with you some specific steps I've taken and principles I've applied to my own life to help me take my eyes off of other people and put them back on creating the life I want to live for myself. Step 1, change your perspective. In the last chapter, we said that what we see on social media doesn't always reflect reality. It's usually not the complete picture of someone's life. It's the highlight reel. That's true for other people. And if we're being honest, it's true for us as well. It's not only a social media issue, however. Our perception of reality can be just as skewed in real life. Stuff doesn't equal wealth. One of the most surprising lessons I learned as a teenager is that nice stuff doesn't always equal wealth. Once, when a group of girls from school decided to go to a concert together, one girl in our circle of friends said she couldn't go. She couldn't afford the $100 ticket. Now, don't get me wrong. Paying $100 for a concert ticket in high school was a big deal. I had to do hours of babysitting to earn that money. What surprised me, though, is that this friend drove a brand new luxury car. She wore designer clothes, and her family lived in a super nice house in an expensive neighborhood. I just couldn't wrap my head around the fact that this girl, who looked like she could do anything she wanted, couldn't afford a concert ticket. I talked to my mom about it that night. "Mom, how can she not afford a ticket?" I asked. "She's rich." My mom stopped what she was doing, looked me in the eye, and said something I'll never forget. "Rachel, that's what debt does. It makes people look better off than they actually are. Just because someone looks wealthy doesn't mean they actually are." This may or may not have been my friend's situation in high school, but someone's nice car, fancy jewelry, and giant house could all be based on debt. The show on the outside may not match the truth on the inside. The lesson there for me was that things aren't always what they appear to be. Don't get me wrong. I'm definitely not saying that everyone who has nice things uses debt to get them. A few years ago, a friend confided in me that she and her husband were in major financial trouble. They weren't careless with their money, but life had dealt them a tough blow. She was a teacher, and he had recently lost his job. They were barely getting by on her teacher's salary. Every time I saw her, however, she was wearing a new pair of expensive yoga pants. It may sound silly, but this really started bothering me. I told Winston, I can't believe she has so many pairs of those pants. They can't afford to spend that much money on something so trivial. What are they thinking? Soon after, she and I were hanging out with some other friends, and I overheard her telling someone else that some of her students' moms had pulled their money and given her 3 pairs of those pants for Christmas. She went on and on about how grateful she was for the gift because it gave her a chance to have something nice for herself while she and her husband were facing such difficult money troubles. I felt terrible. I had judged her for something that wasn't even true. It was another hard lesson that you can't always trust your assumptions. Wealth doesn't equal stuff. Another interesting truth is that having wealth doesn't necessarily mean you have nice stuff. We all have ideas of what millionaires look like and how they live, but that's usually based on unrealistic assumptions or TV's portrayal of quote-unquote rich people. The truth is, people who are actually wealthy live a lot differently than you might expect. The late Thomas J. Stanley wrote a fabulous book called The Millionaire Next Door. He spent years studying the behaviors of average millionaires, someone with a net worth of $1 million or more. He meticulously reviewed their lifestyles and concluded that these successful men and women look a lot more like regular people, and not at all like the fancy, well-dressed, well-to-do rich people you see on TV. One of the things he discovered was that the average millionaire drives a 2-year-old or older car. Why? Because when you have as much money as they do, you don't care what other people think. As Stanley interviewed these millionaires, a high percentage of them talked about how they drove used cars and lived in modest homes. They weren't flashy and were pretty conservative in their spending. It was refreshing to read and a good reminder that, again, things aren't always as they seem. Step 2, cheering each other on. I love working at my dad's company, Ramsey Solutions. We do important work, and we get to help people all over the country take control of their money and get out of debt. Some of the success stories we hear blow me away. The really cool part, though, is that the way the team members celebrate each other's progress. You may think that everyone in our office is debt-free, but that's not true. Our team members represent every stage of the financial spectrum. We may all be at different places on the journey, but we're all heading in the same direction. So, we have some millionaires on the team, and we have some people who are fighting through tens of thousands of dollars of debt. And, of course, we have a lot of people somewhere in between. We all dress pretty casually, so it's hard to really tell who's doing well and who's struggling under a pile of student loans. But the one place you can really get a sense of our variety is in the parking lot. When you pull in, you will likely see a few Lexus and Mercedes models, along with several other really nice cars. You will also see a 1980 Chevy Nova with duct tape, rust, and a mix-and-match paint job. But the person getting out of the Mercedes doesn't look down on the person driving the Nova. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. They cheer that person on because they know how hard they're fighting and of the sacrifices they're making to get out of debt. The guy in the Nova doesn't roll his eyes at the people who drive nicer, newer cars either. Again, it's the opposite. He doesn't plan to drive it forever. He looks at the people in the newer cars as huge encouragements, as a sign of where he wants to be himself. There's no comparison game going on here. Instead, we're all cheering each other on. It's an incredible attitude that you can adopt yourself, even if everyone around you doesn't. But you can't do it if you're always comparing your life to other people's. Constantly comparing ourselves to others prevents us from cheering on those who are working hard to get somewhere and celebrating with those who have made it there. So here's the challenge. When a friend tells you about her new job, be happy for her. If someone buys a new house, show some excitement. If someone shares some great news with you, keep the focus on them instead of turning it back on yourself. Find big and small ways to celebrate other people's accomplishments. That's one way we get to show love and support to others. It's like the Bible says, rejoice with those who rejoice, Romans 12:15. Don't feel like you're losing just because someone else is winning. Their success has nothing to do with you, So celebrate their success sincerely while you keep working towards your own. Step 3. Stop looking at your parents. My parents live in a beautiful home. Seriously, it's amazing. They've worked hard and have been responsible with money for decades. And I'm so proud that they're able to enjoy what they've worked so hard for. You know what I don't do when I look at their house? I don't try to figure out how I can buy the one next door. At this point in my life, that's just not going to happen. Mom and Dad have a 30-year head start on Winston and me. We may get there one day, but we aren't there today. The same may be true for you, too. And yet, so many people graduate college, get married, start their careers, and immediately expect to be able to live the same kind of lifestyle as their parents. It's crazy. Why in the world should someone with a starter salary assume that they can live just as well as their hardworking, almost retired parents? Answer, they shouldn't. Winston and I try to keep this in perspective, but it isn't always easy. Sure, the big things like houses or cars are easier to keep a handle on, but I still get tripped up on the little things sometimes. A few years into my career, I went out to eat with my parents and noticed a beautiful new purse my mom had just bought. I told her how gorgeous it was and that I wished that I could have one just like it. Without really thinking much about it, she said sweetly, "Oh, sure, honey, you should go buy one for yourself." When I got home from dinner, I went online to order it and saw the price. Yikes. To say it was out of my newlywed, only working 3 years in the real world budget would be an understatement. At that point, it really hit me that I was still in my early 20s. While I'd been working hard for those 3 years, it didn't grant me the right to go buy whatever I wanted. I needed to live like I was in my early 20s, not like I was in my early 50s. Comparing ourselves to our peers is bad enough. Comparing ourselves to people decades further along in their career and wealth building is just ridiculous. Step 4. Redefine, I deserve it. One of the biggest dangers in comparing ourselves to others is the spirit of entitlement it can create. We see someone else's success and think, I work harder than he does. I should have what he has. I deserve it. Deserve is a dangerous word and gets people into more trouble than they ever expect or care to admit. The belief that the world owes us something is why so many of us live in a constant state of dissatisfaction and jealousy. I fall into this trap at times. I start to tell myself why I deserve something, or better, why I should have the same or better than someone else. I tell myself, Rachel, you work so hard. You deserve a nice vacation. You need newer clothes than what you have in your closet. Whenever I do this, I'm having a classic Veruca Salt from Willy Wonka-style tantrum. I might as well stomp my feet and scream, I want it! I want it right now! It's hard to admit that I do that occasionally, but I do. And these pity parties are almost always when I'm alone in my car or by myself at home. They usually happen in my head, at least for about half an hour, before I snap out of it and back to reality. Maybe, just maybe, I'm not the only one. I have to stop in those times and remind myself that I don't deserve anything. The only things I deserve to buy are what Winston and I plan for and pay cash for. That's it. Period. If it's not part of our plan and we don't have the cash on hand, we make it a goal to work hard toward it in the future. I have to remind myself that having it right this second isn't an option, so I just need to move on. How's that for a pep talk? Step 5. Own your stuff. Growing up, I always heard my parents say, it's okay to have nice stuff, just don't let your nice stuff have you. What they meant is that sometimes we give in to the pursuit of stuff for the wrong reasons. People make bad decisions and go into debt for things that they don't need and can't afford. Then, once they have the thing that they think will make them happy, they get distracted by something else and start chasing after it instead. The end result is a big pile of nice stuff with a lot of debt and misery attached. The road of comparisons will always dead end at debt. Remember, it's okay to have nice things. There's nothing wrong with enjoying a little luxury as long as it makes sense in your world. However, when you pile up a bunch of stuff and go neck deep into debt to buy it all, you don't really own your stuff. It owns you. Debt takes over, steals all of your income, and you suddenly become a servant to the things you thought would make you happy. We'll talk a lot more about debt and wise spending later. For now, I just want to encourage you to examine your buying motives before you make a purchase. If your identity and your life's worth are wrapped up in what you're buying, you're setting yourself up for disaster. The cure for comparisons. Too many people allow cultural expectations, that is, other people, to dictate their own values and family priorities. I've been there too. I know it's an empty and endless battle to try to keep up. You feel like a hamster on a wheel, running as hard and as fast as you can, and ultimately going nowhere. Doing that for a lifetime will leave you completely exhausted. But your life doesn't have to look like that. There is hope. There is an antidote. There is one and only one cure to comparison living, and that is contentment. What contentment looks like. In our book, Smart Money, Smart Kids, my dad and I make the point that content people don't always have the best of everything, but they make the best of everything. Contentment isn't a place you get to financially. It's a place you get to emotionally and spiritually. It's a peace in your spirit that knows what you have, no matter how much or how little, is enough. Contentment is the inner determination to be happy and fulfilled wherever you are with whatever you have. The Apostle Paul put it like this: I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. Philippians 4:11. And yes, I know this is a lot easier said than done. I wish I could give you specific steps to guarantee your contentment, but I can't. I will tell you the two big secrets to living a contented life, but before we get there, let's take a look at what a content person looks like. You may realize that you have some of these people around you already. You may even realize that you are one yourself. Content people are satisfied. Contentment allows you to be in a state of joy and satisfaction. You are happy with where you are in life. That doesn't mean you don't have goals for the future or that you aren't working toward being a better person than you are today. It definitely doesn't mean that you are stagnant or apathetic, or that you're choosing to sit around and do nothing new, exciting, and challenging with your life. It just means that you have a peace about your life and a sincere enjoyment about what you have today without basing all your happiness on what you hope to achieve tomorrow. Since we're talking about comparisons, I will give you one big tip here. It's almost impossible to be satisfied with your own life if you're constantly looking at what someone else has. If you're struggling to appreciate the blessings in your life, and if you're constantly distracted by the hashtag blessings of other people, it may be time to put some blinders on for a little while. Shut off the social media networks. Stop strolling through the mall. Unsubscribe from all the email newsletters and advertisements that try to convince you how much you're missing. Spend that time and energy focusing on how much you truly have. Look at your family, your friends, your home, your job, and all the things in your life that really matter. Then rejoice in what you have. Content people are at peace. Comparisons bring discontentment, and discontentment brings anxiety. Have you ever noticed how stressed you start to feel when you're focused on other people's stuff? That happens to me every now and then. Like when I'm scrolling through that fashion blogger's Greek Isles pictures after my Charleston trip. If you ever find your mood changing while you're on social media, that may be a sign that you need to back off for a while. Focusing on the blessings in your own life helps you get past all of that. When you are content, you are at peace about your life. You may not be where you want to be yet, but you're comfortable about where you're heading. And just as important, you're able to be comfortable with where someone else is heading to. That's when you become the kind of friend who can genuinely celebrate someone else's victories and accomplishments. Don't we love the friend who can be happy for us? Don't we avoid the friends we know will put a dark cloud over our heads? When we are at peace with our lives, our relationships get better because we become the kind of friend other people want to have. Content people save more and avoid debt. This one may be a no-brainer, but content people aren't interested in burying themselves under a pile of debt in order to buy stuff they think will make them happy. And since they aren't trying to one-up other people, they usually save more and build wealth over the long haul. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? Those who seem the least interested in the appearance of wealth are often the ones who build the most wealth over time. Funny how that works, isn't it? Content people are generous. Generosity makes us so much more of who we want to be. It's hard to realize, then, that a lot of the comparison-based decisions we make every day take us further and further away from this ideal. We are busy investing all of our attention and money into keeping up with the Joneses. We usually don't have enough left to invest in other people and worthy causes. When you get to a place where you are satisfied with what you have, you realize you have plenty left to give to others. We'll talk more about giving later. The two keys to contentment: gratitude and humility. So, how do we work towards a life of contentment? I believe it starts with a grateful heart. There is no room for discontentment in a heart filled with gratitude. As my friend Chris Hogan often says, it's hard to be hateful when you're grateful. That's why it's such a good idea to stop often and take inventory of all the incredible blessings in our lives. A local pastor recently hit the message pretty hard in a sermon series. He challenged his church to focus on the issue of gratitude by posting to social media 5 things they're grateful for every day for a week. It's a big church, and the response was huge. I have a lot of friends and coworkers who go to this church, so my social media feeds were blowing up with these gratitude posts. The posts covered everything from kids to health to jobs. One friend even posted, "I'm thankful for being tired and sore, because that means I have 2 legs that allow me to run." I love seeing these posts, probably because the spirit about them